Hello and welcome to the Political History of the United States. Episode 4.32, the 1775 Invasion of Canada. By the time that August 1775 had rolled around, George Washington found himself in Cambridge holding Boston under siege. Although Washington had been itching for a battle, when his senior officers vetoed such an audacious plan, Washington, begrudgingly, accepted their guidance. However, this is not to say that 1775 was going to be without further action, as Washington's and indeed Congress's eyes turned to the North. After a bit of initial vacillation on the matter, by the end of June 1775, Congress had decided to reverse on their earlier policy to leave Canada alone, and authorized Philip Schuyler to command an assault. This was, in no small part, encouraged by both Ethan Allen and Benedict Arnold, who assured Congress that, at least for the time being, Canada was lightly garrisoned and a mission to capture it would be easy. Congress was also busy grappling with rumors that the British governor of Canada, Guy Carleton, was busy assembling an army of French, Indians, and British regulars to march down into the colonies and seize control of the Hudson River Valley, effectively dividing the colonies in two and isolating New England. Carleton was himself no pushover either. Although he is not somebody who we have mentioned by name, he has been on the periphery of our story for a while now. Carleton was the quartermaster under James Wolfe, and was there on that September day when the British launched their assault on the Plains of Abraham as they moved on Quebec. It was in this same battle that Wolfe would die. Despite the death of General Wolfe, Carleton was able to grow his influence, and now found himself facing an army of rebels from the Lower 13 colonies. Carleton was facing this while he personally was left with little more than scraps to attempt to save Canada from falling into the hands of radically recalcitrant colonists. This week, we turn to that invasion of Canada. For those of you who spent those 18 wonderful episodes with me during the French and Indian War, this week is really going to be something of a throwback. We are going to be traveling to so many of our old favorite haunts. And yet again, you're going to hear me butcher each and every French name I come across in new and creative ways. So, let's dive in. The sudden about-face from Congress came with a real concern that Carleton was indeed planning a mission to march through the Hudson Valley in order to divide the colonies. It is important to note, though, that the colonists in the Lower 13 colonies ultimately wanted to ally themselves with Canada. What Washington envisioned was that the colonies were more or less on a mission of liberation rather than conquest. He viewed Canada as being the 14th colony. If Canada would join in with the cause of the other colonies, it would help secure much of the northern border. It would help limit exposure to the Lower 13 colonies from invasion from the north, as it would take away that critical passage along the St. Lawrence River. I've already mentioned it once here today, but should the British have invaded through the Hudson River Valley, they could have potentially isolated everything from New York to the north, with New England essentially cut off and surrounded. It would be just a matter of time before the present rebellion came to an unceremonious end. Command over the invasion of Canada was given to Philip Schuyler of New York. Born in 1733, Schuyler was a member of one of the richest and most powerful families in New York. During the French and Indian War, he had served and fought in several major battles, including at both Carillon and at Fort Frontenac. Schuyler is today perhaps best known for being the eventual father-in-law of Alexander Hamilton. However, that is still several years off, and for now, he would have to busy himself with the command of a mission into Canada. Washington envisioned that the invasion would come in two parts. One was going to move from New York to the north, through all of our favorite French and Indian locations. The group would move up into Lake George, then into Lake Champlain, then on into the Richelieu River and past Illinois, before heading on to Montreal and ultimately Quebec. The second group, under the command of Benedict Arnold, would move north through the wilderness, before turning west and approaching Quebec from the east. Beginning with Arnold, we find a man who is brimming with optimism about his prospects moving into Canada. Washington had given him command of 1,100 men, all primed to move north through Maine, before turning to the west, towards Quebec. It was late in the season for a Canadian expedition. Recall from back in our episodes on the 1759 British assault on Quebec. Wolfe had been desperate to get something done that September, as cold weather was quickly threatening to trap the British fleet. Arnold, though, was seemingly unfazed by this fact, despite not leaving until September 11th. It may have helped Arnold's optimism that he had greatly underestimated the task in front of him. Arnold believed that he was looking at a trip of right around 180 miles, a trip that he estimated would take him 20 days. In reality, the trip was 350 miles and took him 45 days. The extra distance in time was not something that Arnold had factored into his equation when planning the mission. This means that despite leaving with what he believed to be plenty of food, he was actually woefully undersupplied. Furthermore, much of the early portion of the trek involved trips along various rivers leading north through Maine. During these trips along the rivers, a large portion of the food became wet and was thus destroyed. The rivers that Arnold and company were crossing were not calm streams, and often included treacherous rapids. Nothing about this journey was easy, and for those who accompanied Arnold into the wilderness, they were met with absolutely miserable conditions. With the food supply quickly becoming exhausted, the men also found themselves having to face treacherous terrain. Departing so late in the season meant that the weather had already begun turning much colder. In short order, the rain began to transition into snow. The rivers that needed to be crossed included those fierce rapids. This was exhausting work, and the lack of food soon had the desperate troops eating anything that they could find, including their own leather shoes and wax candles. This brings us to one of the key problems with the early Continental Army. Despite now being called an army, things were still far more chaotic than one would expect from a professional army, with abject misery all around them. At the end of Arnold's column, Roger Enos was in charge of a division. Enos allowed himself to be persuaded by his officers that the mission was a complete lost cause, and that really, the only option was to turn around and head for home. Enos would officially claim opposition to the idea of withdrawing, but instead would claim that the mutinous machinations of his officers left him with no real choice. Although in reality, it does not appear that anybody really had to twist his arm all that hard. With that, Enos, along with three companies, turned around and went back towards New England. Benedict Arnold was never consulted and was seemingly unaware that nearly half of his army had, just like that, melted away. Arnold wrote to Washington on November 8th, expressing his surprise at Enos' departure. On November 3rd, those still along for the march finally found relief when several oxen were purchased. Immediately slaughtered, the men would eat for the first time in over a week. Some of the men were so hungry that, reportedly, they ate themselves to death. Days later, on November 8th, Arnold and company arrived at Point Levis, on the opposite side of the St. Lawrence River from Quebec. This is the same location where, in 1759, Wolfe had led the bombardment of Quebec. As Arnold found himself looking across the St. Lawrence River at Quebec, it would be a good time to remember that he was only one part of the planned assault on that city. There was still the matter of Philip Schuyler's army. Arnold's mission had always been meant to be secondary to the main attack by Schuyler. When Washington had sent Arnold north, the plan had always been that it would weaken British resistance in the south, by forcing Carleton to divert his men to the north to deal with Arnold. Schuyler was not exactly moving with much of a sense of urgency throughout the summer of 1775, In fact, Schuyler was nowhere near the actual army, which was still hanging out near Fort Ticonderoga, which had been captured a few months earlier. Schuyler had left Richard Montgomery in command of the army in his absence. Although Schuyler seemed to lack any real motivation to move, on August 28th, Montgomery decided that it was time to set the plan into action. Montgomery was, like Arnold, in charge of roughly 1,200 troops when he departed from Ticonderoga. His path north looked much like what the 1760 invasion had looked like. American troops moved north from Ticonderoga through Lake Champlain and then into the Richelieu River. All went pretty smoothly for Montgomery and the Americans. Right up until they hit the town of Saint-Jean, a small town along the Richelieu River some 25 miles to the southwest of Montreal. The 1,200 Americans were brought to a hard stop by 60 British allied Indian warriors. Suddenly, this group of 60 had Montgomery's men pinned down outside of Saint-Jean. Now, Montgomery decided to play it cautious here. What he did not want to do is speed run past this Indian tribe and race towards Montreal. The concern was that doing this would have endangered his rear, as that Indian tribe in Saint-Jean could then turn around and chase them and pin them in between the British defenders in Montreal and themselves. Montgomery was not about to take what he viewed as being nothing more than a reckless risk, and instead concluded that he would have to capture Saint-Jean before moving on. The problem is that not all of his officers agreed with him. In this case, it was Ethan Allen and John Brown of New York who decided to just go ahead and take Montreal on their own. This is another display of the haphazard leadership that would dominate the early part of the revolution. While Allen and Brown were not shrinking from the task, like we saw Enos do earlier today, they did decide to basically just bypass Montgomery altogether and just do their own thing. The problem for Allen and Brown is that doing their own thing is not going to work nearly as well as they had hoped. Allen was accompanied by his Green Mountain Boys, the same group that had captured Ticonderoga and Crown Point seemingly with ease. To make matters more convoluted, it is not as though Ethan Allen and John Brown were working together on anything resembling a coordinated attack. Rather, they were moving as two completely independent units. Although Ethan Allen would make it across the St. Lawrence, the men under Brown's command never did arrive. This left Allen and his Green Mountain Boys very much alone, isolated and outnumbered. There was no need for a prolonged battle because for Ethan Allen, there was absolutely no hope of victory. There were some minor skirmishes, but that was about it. He had badly miscalculated and found himself surrendering to a 16-year-old ensign named Peter Johnson. Johnson was, incidentally, the son of our old friend William Johnson from back in our French and Indian War days. Taking the opportunity to wrap up William Johnson's story, he had died a year earlier from a stroke. For Ethan Allen, his war was more or less over. He would remain in British custody until 1778 when he was freed in a prisoner exchange. George Washington would make him a colonel. However, this was more ceremonial than anything else. Allen was never given his own command and never again meaningfully participated in the revolution. Okay, so not a great start for Montgomery. It was not until November 2nd that Montgomery was able to take care of Saint-Jean and move on to Montreal. It was at around the same time that he became aware that Arnold was closing in on Quebec. By this point, Carleton had decided that the British stand in the defense of Canada would be launched from Quebec and not Montreal. We have actually talked about this previously, way back in episode 3.40. Although the players had changed, geography had not. Quebec, with its steep cliffs, was a far more defendable position than Montreal was. With Montgomery now quickly approaching, Carleton decided that it was a good time to move north to protect Quebec. This means that when Montgomery finally arrived on November 13th, there would be no great battle. Carleton and company were already on their way north. As a reminder of where we sit on our timeline, Benedict Arnold had just arrived outside of Quebec, near Pointe-Levis, on November 8th, where he was now just hanging out, trying not to freeze to death, and awaiting Montgomery's arrival for the assault on Quebec itself. Benedict Arnold found himself getting more and more nervous by the day. He was well aware that further delay just meant that Quebec was becoming that much more prepared. Yet, despite his anxiety, Arnold was well aware that attacking Quebec on his own would be a mistake. He needed the extra men that Montgomery would bring to the assault. So, rather than move, he was forced to sit and wait nervously for Montgomery's arrival throughout November. Arnold was aware of the capture of Montreal, and would spend the month sending Montgomery a barrage of intelligence reports. Arnold had little else that he could do as he waited for Montgomery, so he took to intelligence gathering, likely also wanting to keep nudging Montgomery to hurry up. Arnold would likewise take a liking during this time to a young soldier, whom he was using as a messenger, and ultimately he would recommend to Montgomery that this young man, a man named Aaron Burr, should be placed on his staff. It was not as though Montgomery was delaying because he was enjoying sightseeing down in Montreal. Rather, he had run into a serious problem, one that would plague the Continental Army throughout the entire war, but especially during these early stages. Montgomery was facing down problems of the extraordinarily short enlistment periods. The New England soldiers along with him had their commissions expiring at the end of 1775, and they had made it abundantly clear that they were ready to go home. Rather than racing everybody north to link up with Arnold, Montgomery found himself busy trying to persuade, to mixed results, the colonists to stay and fight just a little while longer. These delays meant that Montgomery did not even begin sailing down the St. Lawrence with 300 troops under his command until November 28th. Even before Montgomery had left Montreal, Carleton had managed to get back into Quebec. After a somewhat harrowing journey that nearly saw the British commander captured, Carleton arrived back in Quebec on November 19th. Arnold and company saw the ship carrying him into the city, though there was little they could really do about it. Likewise, at the time, none of them knew that among the passengers was Carleton. Regardless of the missed opportunity, now that Carleton was back, he turned to the task of preparing Quebec, not only for a battle, but for the very real possibility of a prolonged siege. He was not just planning on surrendering the city after a few days, as we had seen so many times during the French and Indian War. He wanted to make sure that they were well provisioned and that they could hold out until the spring of 1776, when British reinforcements would be able to enter the St. Lawrence and relieve him. Carleton was making preparations that, should the need arise, the defenders of Quebec could hunker down for up to 8 months in the event that the Americans managed to establish a siege. It was not until December 1st that Montgomery arrived to link up with Arnold. The time for an attack was not exactly ideal. A Canadian winter was not something for the faint-hearted. However, Arnold and Montgomery were both aware that they had few options. Should they not strike immediately, they ran the risk that the New York enlistments would expire on January 1st, and the accompanying widespread desertion. Both men had already dealt with this, and should they lose any more men, moving on Quebec would have become nearly impossible. Hunkering down and waiting until the spring was also out, as it would risk British reinforcements arriving. If Montgomery and Arnold were going to make their move, it was going to be sooner rather than later. Arnold and Montgomery quickly came to the conclusion that an assault would be required as compared to a siege. There were a few logistical reasons that a siege was ruled out. First, we return to that problem that the enlistments were going to expire at the end of the year, at which point there was some question as to whether or not Arnold and Montgomery would even have an army to do anything with at all. The other problem, however, was the actual logistics of a siege. We spent significant time already on the show detailing the process of sieges, which includes, critically, the digging of trenches for siege lines. However, it was now December in Canada. The ground was frozen solid, and nobody was going to be digging into it. This is to say nothing for the fact that Carleton was well provisioned, and if the St. Lawrence thawed before the provincials could take the city, they would find themselves badly exposed as the British Navy entered the river. All right, so with no other viable option, it was going to be a direct assault on Quebec. For the next several weeks, the provincial troops took to the task of preparing for the coming battle. On December 15th, they opened up an artillery barrage on the city. At this point, Carleton does not really have a whole lot that he can do. His plan was essentially to survive until the spring, when the British Navy could enter the river and relieve him. This was all going on under the most miserable conditions you can imagine. These preparations were taking place during brutal cold, with several men reporting frostbite. Despite the ongoing preparations, both Montgomery and Arnold still would have been happy to avoid a battle. Also, on December 15th, the same day that the bombardment had begun, they had offered a generous peace to Carleton, although he had no intention of either accepting or surrendering. There were likewise attempts made to rattle the defenders' nerves as the riflemen under Daniel Morgan took up sniper positions and terrorized any man who walked exposed on the ramparts inside the city. The plan was for Benedict Arnold and his 600 men to attack the lower city from the northwest, taking up a position near the St. Charles River and then moving towards the east. Meanwhile, Montgomery and his 300 men would attack from the south, moving first to the east and then the north along the cliffs. Once the lower city was under control, the two armies would join up for a joint strike against the upper town. Using the miserable weather to their advantage, the plan called for a late-night attack under the cover of bad weather. None of this was a particular surprise to Carleton. He recognized that the two land approaches that the provincials planned on attacking were indeed his weak points, and subsequently took up efforts to reinforce those spots with as many men as he could spare. Carleton used barricades and whatever cover he could find in the region to hide the troops, with the hope that when the moment came, he would be able to surprise the unexpected invaders. The first planned assault on the city was set for December 27th. All day, a powerful snowstorm had made a mess of things, which is exactly what Montgomery and Arnold were looking for. However, as the men were all getting ready for the assault, the weather suddenly cleared up, the moon came out, and nicely illuminated the entire battlefield. If the goal was a stealth approach, that was now impossible, and Montgomery called off the attack. By this point, Carleton was well aware that the fight was coming. He, too, knew that the enlistments were about to run out and that the attack was going to come before the end of the year. As a result, he ordered his men to sleep in their uniforms and to be ready at a moment's notice. With time running out, the attack finally came during the early morning hours of December 31st. As hoped, a powerful snowstorm was raging, which would, at least Montgomery and Arnold hoped, provide the necessary cover for the invading Americans. As was the plan days before, Arnold was moving towards the east, with Montgomery beginning on the Plains of Abraham and moving north along the cliffs. Although Carleton had a manpower advantage, the Americans were banking on the dual assault, helping to mitigate that problem by forcing Carleton to spread out his forces. As the storm intensified at 4 a.m., Montgomery and his men began moving up the plains. Despite the adverse weather, Carleton was ready and the American movement was quickly detected. As Arnold moved forward, hearing the British inside the town rapidly getting ready, he and his men were hit with an unexpected barrage of gunfire. Benedict Arnold was struck in the leg and had to be escorted from the battlefield. Daniel Morgan would quickly take command over the troops. If things were going poorly for Arnold, they were much, much worse for Montgomery. Montgomery had made it through the first barricade along the cliffs and was now approaching the second. After crawling through a long barricade, Montgomery emerged and found himself looking at a small log cabin. Unfortunately for the Americans with Montgomery, they did not realize that the house was anything but empty. When the general alarm had sounded, several men had fled into the house. Right as Montgomery went to signal a charge, he was shot at close range in the head, dying instantly. It wasn't just Montgomery either, as several members of his officer corps were cut down as well. This had the effect of causing the men behind Montgomery to decide that it was a pretty good time to turn and get out of there, sending everybody crashing back towards where they had just been. Among those rapidly retreating from that log cabin where Montgomery had just died was Aaron Burr. From here, everything just turned into a mess. Despite some attempts by Colonel Donald Campbell to stop the retreat and get them into advance, everybody was just too shaken up. Making matters worse is that the gunpowder had become wet, making firing their guns difficult. With both Arnold and Montgomery now down, Daniel Morgan found himself in nominal control over the entire mission. Morgan, who, recall, was up with the troops that had initially begun under the command of Arnold, would briefly put on a show of bravery, making a last attempt to save the day. Unfortunately for Morgan, his advanced troops were moving faster than the rest of his column. The British exploited this and flooded into that gap to the rear of his advanced troops. Just like that, Morgan's show of bravery came to an end as he and his men found themselves surrounded. With no other option, Morgan found himself forced into a surrender. The Battle of Quebec was over. In the immediate aftermath, the question turned to the losses. Most of the men who had been under Montgomery's command had survived. Their battle had come to an end following their commander's death and their hasty retreat. There was, however, more concern over the men who had been under Arnold's command. As mentioned a moment ago, they had pushed on despite Arnold's injuries. At the end of the day, 51 Americans were dead, another 36 wounded, and hundreds had been taken prisoner. A majority of those who now found themselves as prisoners of war had been part of that group that had marched with Arnold through the wilderness. Nearly two-thirds of that group that remained had been captured. British losses stood at 7 dead, with another 11 wounded. Despite still convalescing from his leg wound, Benedict Arnold took over for Montgomery as the commander on the scene. He pulled the Americans back by about a mile, and then he settled in for the winter. Although the Americans had suffered a serious loss, Arnold did not pull all the way south to the more secure confines of Montreal, instead choosing to keep his men in the field. The loss outside of Quebec was not entirely surprising. We only need to look back 2 episodes to see the dangers of attempting to assault a fortified location. However, unlike what we had seen at Bunker Hill, where it was the British crashing into the fortified locations, it was now the Americans' turn to make the same errors. Although they had banked on the element of surprise, for Carleton it was not exactly difficult to predict when the American attack was going to come. He was aware of the expiring New York enlistments and knew that the Americans had their backs to the wall. This loss would help to highlight some of the shortcomings of the Continental Army in 1775. Congress proved slow to vote for reinforcements to head to Canada. Even before the Battle of Quebec, Congress was considering the question of approving more troops and had sent it to a committee. The leader of this committee, however, was John Dickinson, the leader of the group still seeking a peaceful end to the conflict and reconciliation. Although pleas from Philip Schuyler were eventually answered with the granting of more troops in January, it had become increasingly clear to many that fighting a war for the purpose of reconciliation was an untenable position. The Battle of Quebec had also done much to illustrate the dangers that come with short enlistments. The Americans found themselves forced into a battle partially because they knew that had January 1st come without an attack, they were at risk of those New York troops up and leaving. As we move forward, we will see that this is not going to be the last time that these short enlistments caused the Patriot leadership headaches, as it is going to become something of a theme during the early part of the Revolution. Next time, we are going to bring our 1775 narrative to a close and move the war into the all-important year of 1776. Until then, I hope you all have an excellent 2 weeks. I hope that you are staying healthy and that you are staying safe. And I will see you back here next time to ring in 1776.